Well, good morning, Hope Chapel. Welcome back to Hope at Home. If you're visiting with us this morning, checking out our stream for the very first time, my name is Mike Nazarian, and I have the very great privilege of serving as one of our teaching pastors here at Hope. Church, first thing this morning, I want to take just a moment and share some very difficult news with our church family. Many of you know that our very beloved Tanya Navarro passed away tragically and unexpectedly this past Wednesday evening. I know that I speak for all of us when I say that we're heartbroken, that we'll miss Tanya very, very much. Tanya was a beautiful, kind, and a supremely compassionate woman of God. She's survived by her husband, Angel, and their seven children, Jaden, Alexis, Cassie, Angel Jr., Stephanie, Bethany, and Eric. Angel, if you and the kids are watching, I just want to say on behalf of our church family, we love you guys. We're praying for you. We mourn with you. Our hearts ache with your hearts, and we will do whatever we can do to support you as you move forward and as we move forward as a church family. We love you guys very much, and we'll miss Tanya very, very, very dearly. Okay, church, this morning we're going to be continuing our teaching through the book of Ruth. We just started this brief series last weekend. Pastor Andrew kicked us off. So this morning we're going to be continuing in Ruth chapter 1. Verses 6 through 22. So if you have your Bibles where you're sitting, I want to invite you to open them to Ruth chapter 1 and read along with me what is recorded in the book of Ruth chapter 1, beginning in verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return to you with your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in the womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters. For it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Church, this is the word of the Lord. Well, sometimes life punches you in the stomach. And sometimes that punch is unfathomably devastating. This punch might come to us in the form of injury, tragedy, loss, failure, betrayal, or any number of possible life events that threaten to obliterate any sense of happiness and hope that we have. These moments can cause us to question the presence of God, the favor of God, the goodness of God, and sometimes even the existence of God. Oftentimes, it's tragic and painful life events that compel us to consider these most difficult questions that can be asked and answered in our lifetimes. The Bible doesn't shy away from these experiences or from these questions. In fact, it leans into them. The biblical worldview presents answers to these questions that are utterly unique, and I think the only answers that satisfy our deepest longings. Oftentimes, these answers are contained in or encapsulated in biblical themes. Ruth presents to us several of these biblical themes. Now, Pastor Andrew and I, leading up to this series in our time of discussion and preparation, have prayerfully agreed to emphasize the following three themes as we teach through the book of Ruth together. Those three themes are providence, devotion, and redemption. Two of those three themes emerge prominently in this first chapter, in the verses that we're considering this morning. This passage corresponds to Act 1 of a four-part or four-act story. Now, the first theme that we're looking at is referred to as a providence or divine providence. Divine providence is the governance of God by which He, through wisdom and love, cares for and directs all things in the universe. This doctrine asserts that God is in complete control of all things. He is sovereign over the universe as a whole, over the physical world, over the affairs of nations, over human destiny, over human successes and failures, and over the protection of His people. This doctrine also asserts that God is even sovereign over the upcoming election. We should take comfort in that. But this doctrine stands in direct opposition to kind of the contemporary idea that the universe is just governed by randomness, chance, or fate. So here in chapter 1, we will see very clearly God's providence. And we also see that sometimes His providence is painful. Now, the second theme we see in the book of Ruth, and especially in the person of Ruth, is devotion. We see an amazing devotion. Devotion in the presence of incalculable pain, and devotion against all odds of human benefit. Now, I think that it's helpful for us to briefly review the events of the beginning of the chapter. Last week, Pastor Andrew focused on the opening and closing verses of Ruth as kind of bookends for the whole story. And so in doing so, he briefly led us through chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, which serve as a kind of introduction or prologue to the story as a whole. But these first five verses are crucial to us this morning, feeling the full impact of the rest of the chapter, verses 6 through 22. So I just want to briefly fly through the significant facts and events in verses 1 through 5. So the narrator begins by telling us that this story takes place in the days when the judges ruled. Now, this particular period of Israel's history, it was dark and it was sinful. It was characterized by the cyclical pattern of God's people forsaking Him and turning to foreign gods and to sinful living. And God would consequently give Israel over to her enemies until Israel repented and cried out for help. And then, in His mercy, God would raise up a judge to deliver Israel, to deliver His people. So over and over and over again in Judges, we see Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God, and we see Israel, the covenant-breaking people. And yet, being gracious and merciful, Yahweh repeatedly and ultimately delivers Israel. So the point is this: Ruth doesn't take place during a golden era of Israel's history. Quite the contrary. Instead, Ruth is set in one of the darkest eras of Israel's history, an era that represented the darkest of times. And so here's what we can't miss. The historical events that Ruth preserves for us show us this amazing timeless truth. God is faithful even in the darkest of times. Now, next we're told that there was a famine in the land. When we look to God's old covenant promises to his old covenant people, Israel, we see that those promises were very much tied to the land that he gave to them, the promised land. Look at what God says to his people in Leviticus chapter 26. He says to them, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commands and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last to the time of the grape harvest, and the grape harvest shall last the time for sowing, and you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land securely. Now, conversely, sometimes God sends famine upon the land in response to Israel's unfaithfulness. So it's not hard to make that connection here at the beginning of Ruth. We shouldn't be surprised to read that during the period of the judges, a dark period, a sinful period, an idolatrous period, that there was a famine in the land. Now finally, in the first five verses of chapter 1, we're introduced to all the main characters. We're introduced to Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They are a family of Bethlehem in Judah, hardly an insignificant little town in the whole of biblical history. Now, what happens with Elimelech? He's faced with this famine in the land, and he has a choice to make. Does he remain in the promised land? Does he remain in the land that God promised to his forefather Abraham? Does he remain in the land that God led his people to by the hand of Moses? Does he remain in the land that God delivered over to his people by the hand and sword of Joshua? Does he remain in the land which signifies so very tangibly Yahweh's personal covenant promises and care? Or does Elimelech look for provision elsewhere? Well, we know that tragically Elimelech leaves. And this is a profound act of unbelief. Why? Because his circumstances loom so much greater in his head and in his heart than his God. Not only does he leave, but he leaves for Moab, one of Israel's sworn enemies in the judges' period. He leaves to live amongst the Moabites. The Moabites were incestual descendants of Lot and his daughters. They leave to live in Moab, the city that worships the false god Chemosh. So Elimelech and his family went into the country of Moab and remained there, we're told in verse 2. In the very next verse, we read that Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. And here's the thing. The apples don't fall far from the tree. Elimelech's sons, while in Moab, take for themselves Moabite wives, another act of infidelity to Yahweh. They're living in violation of his ordinance. The text simply tells us that his sons lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion, and what happened? They died. So the author leaves it to us, leaves it to the reader to draw the conclusion. Covenant curses have fallen on Elimelech and his sons, all three of whom are covenant breakers. And in summary fashion, the narrator simply states, the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Now, we can't miss this little detail. You see, Naomi's desolation is emphasized by the fact that she's not even referred to by name here at the end of verses 1 through 5, but simply as the woman. Now, these events set the stage for our passage this morning for the remainder of chapter 1, for act 1 of this story. Now, the title of this story, the title of this book in the Bible is Ruth, because Ruth is the central character. But this chapter, chapter 1, is about Naomi. This chapter begins on a note of God's providence. It opens with God taking the initiative. Look with me again at verse 6. It says, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food." So we can already understand that the circumstances couldn't get much darker for Naomi. She is laboring to survive in a foreign nation. She has lost her husband. 10 years pass. She loses her only two sons. She has no grandchildren. She's left to look after her daughters-in-law, who are themselves foreigners. I can hardly imagine a more emotionally desolate place for Naomi to be. And in the midst of her darkness, in the darkest moment of her struggle to survive, in the midst of all the personal fallout and devastating loss that she is contending with, God sends a glimmer of light. She receives word that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. Now, on the level of divine action, we see the clear and distinct providence of God. The God who sends famine now sends food. On the level of human action, we see the clear and distinct choice that Ruth has in front of her. Continue to lead a life of servitude in a foreign land amongst a foreign people who serve a foreign god, stay in the place that occasioned the death of her husband and only two sons, or return to her land, to her people, and to Yahweh, her God. Her clear choice on a human level is to return. In his providence, God redirects Naomi's attention from Moab back to Bethlehem, back to Judah. He gives her reason to return from the land of Chemosh to the land of Yahweh. And what do we see next? Verse 7. "So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah." Verse 7 begins, "So she set out." You see, God initiates, Naomi responds. This is divine providence at work. Now, at this point, the narrative shifts from emphasizing God's providence to emphasizing Naomi's misery. Look with me at verses 8 through 13. You see, whereas Naomi's miseries, the events, are recounted in verses 1 through 5, Naomi's experience of those miseries, her emotions, her thoughts, are recounted here in verses 8 through 13. So let's read these verses again together. "But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband.' Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, 'No, we will return with you to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." I think that these verses 8 through 13, serve at least two important narrative functions. First, these verses emphasize for us Naomi's misery. These verses tell us a great deal about what Naomi is going through. As an elderly or older Jewish woman, Naomi would certainly have understood that it's the Lord who sends and relieves famine. She surely would have been familiar with God's promises in Leviticus, including how God's blessing, his promises, are tied to the land. As we looked at previously, God promises people, "If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase." Surely Naomi would have been familiar with these promises. She surely would have remembered the story of Joseph and how God used Joseph in the midst of famine significantly in Israel's history to save his brothers and therefore to save Israel. She surely would have been familiar with the words of Psalm 105, a psalm in her Bible, in our Bibles, dedicated to recounting, to rehearsing the wonderful works of the Lord on behalf of Israel. Look with me at two verses in that psalm, Psalm 105, 16 through 17. When he summoned a famine on the land and broke all supply of bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. And Naomi certainly understood from the scriptures that it is God who sends famines. Naomi surely understood that God sent Joseph ahead of his brothers, sold as a slave, and taken to Egypt. Furthermore, Naomi surely understood that God had called his people to be separate from the surrounding peoples, to be nationally, morally, and spiritually distinct, to be his light to the surrounding nations and to the surrounding peoples. Surely she understood that going to Moab was flirting with disaster. They went to Moab, her husband died. Surely she understood that her sons taking Moabite wives was risky business. They married Moabites and they died childless. We need to understand that there can be no doubt that Naomi rightly recognized the hand of God. She had no difficulty recognizing his sovereignty. But the question consuming her soul wasn't who, but why. Naomi's problem is not that she can't recognize God's providence. Naomi's problem is that God's providence has been to her a painful providence. And that is why she says to Ruth and to Orpah, "Know, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And not once, not twice, but three times in verses 8 through 13, Naomi tells her daughters-in-law, "Go back, turn back, go back." She's saying to them, "God is against me. Do you want him to be against you also? There is nothing for you with me except for misery. Your life, if you come with me, will be as miserable as my life. Go back, go back, go back." But second, these verses pave the way in this story for redemption. Now, we're separated from these events and from this text by 3,000 years, by time and space and culture. We need to understand that there was an ancient custom that God had established in Israel, one that is outlined in our Bibles in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And according to this custom, if an Israelite husband died, his wife was not to move on and marry outside the family, to marry a stranger. Rather, the deceased husband's brother or the nearest relative, the nearest male relative, was to marry that widow and to father children with her. And the firstborn son to that widow and her new husband, the nearest relative of the deceased husband, the firstborn son would then take the name of the deceased brother, thereby perpetuating his name and his legacy in history in Israel. This nearest relative was referred to as the kinsman redeemer, or for short, the redeemer. So look again at what Naomi says to Ruth and Orpah in verses 11, 12, and 13. She says, "Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands?" She says, "Even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown?" So what's Naomi saying to these daughters-in-law of hers? She's saying, "Ladies, there are no redeemers for you. There are no redeemers for you." Naomi is barren. She is childless. She is a widow. She even describes herself as too old to have a husband. From her own human perspective, Naomi has nothing to offer these young women. No good awaits them if they stay with her, only misery. Now remember Naomi's concluding words in this exchange. At the end of verse 13, she says, "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So she's convinced that because God's hand has indeed gone out, and that because the consequences have been unspeakably painful for her, that therefore God's hand must have been directed against her. I have a question for us to consider. Has the hand of the Lord really gone out against her? I think that we need to draw a careful distinction at this point in the text and in the story. We have every indication in the text that God's hand went out, but that it went out against her husband and against her sons. We have no indication in the text that God's hand went out against her. About 10 years ago, John Piper published this beautiful little book, a wonderful treatment of the book of Ruth. And I really fell in love with this book through reading his book. It's one of the reasons I wanted to preach through this book. But I think that John Piper in his book makes the most incisive observation about this moment in the story, in the narrative. You see, he says there's a lesson to be learned right here. And here's the lesson. When we have decided that God is against us, we usually exaggerate our hopelessness. When we have decided that God is against us, we usually exaggerate our hopelessness. And that is exactly what Naomi does. She has decided that God is against her. As a consequence, she has evidently forgotten that there is another relative named Boaz who is available to perform the duty of a redeemer. Sometimes we can become so miserable in our pain that we can't see the glimmers of hope that God gives to us. We can't see them because we convince ourselves that He won't give them to us. It was God who broke the famine and opened Naomi's way home. It was God who preserved a redeemer to continue Naomi's lineage. And it was God who instilled in Ruth such remarkable devotion toward Naomi. So Naomi was correct. The hand of the Lord had indeed gone out, but His hand did not go out against her. His hand went out for her. So next we will turn our attention to Ruth's devotion. From Naomi's misery to Ruth's devotion. Look with me at verse 14. The text tells us, "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." So Orpah is finally dissuaded. She kisses Naomi goodbye. She exits stage left. But Ruth clung to Naomi. So Naomi is so blinded by her misery, so convinced that God is against her, that she pleads with Ruth for a third time. Look at verse 15. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to the people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Go, Naomi tells Ruth. Just go. Go with your sister-in-law. No, Ruth, she won't be dissuaded. And here in Ruth's response to Naomi, we have some of the most beautiful and amazing and memorable words in all of the Bible. Look at what Ruth says to her in verses 16 and 17. "But Ruth said to Naomi, 'Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you.'" These words, I think, are beautiful and amazing and memorable for a number of reasons. First, what is Ruth saying? Ruth is saying that she will leave behind her family, her friends, her land, and everything that she knows and holds dear. Second, Ruth is pledging to accept with Naomi a barren life of widowhood and of childlessness. As far as Ruth knows, Naomi has no one to offer her, no redeemer. Marrying outside of Naomi's family would break her very pledge and is therefore ruled out. With no redeemer to father children for her, and by taking this oath of commitment to Naomi, Ruth is essentially ruling out for herself the possibility of a husband and the possibility of future children. Third, Ruth is committing to a new land, to a new people, a new language, and a new culture. Fourth, Ruth's commitment is even more radical than the commitment in marriage, because she says, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And what this means is that Ruth will never ever return to her home, to her family, not even after Naomi dies. But I think the most astonishing aspect in this moment, in Ruth's pledge, is this. She says, your God will be my God. Now, we have to take Ruth's statement in context with Naomi's earlier statement that the hand of the Lord had gone out against her. So despite Naomi insisting that the hand of the Lord had gone out against her, despite the famine that was sent on their land that sent them to Moab to begin with, despite all of this, despite everything that Ruth has heard from Naomi about her God, Ruth is moved to trust in Naomi's God. Despite Naomi's conviction that God is against her, and despite Naomi's present pain and circumstantial misery. You see, all of this adds up, I think, in this way. Naomi can see nothing but darkness in her future. She has virtually no hope. And here comes Ruth, who clings to her and walks boldly into that darkness with her. So what happens when Ruth says these things? We see in verse 18, and when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So Ruth's devotion, her expression of devotion, essentially leaves Naomi speechless. So they go on their way to Bethlehem, which brings us next to Naomi's bitterness. Look at verse 19 with me. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? So the women of Bethlehem recognized Naomi as Ruth and Naomi coming to town. And now we need to remember that Naomi's name in Hebrew means pleasant. So when the women of the town ask, is this Naomi? They're asking, oh, is this the pleasant one? Has the pleasant one returned? When they ask that question, they're no doubt asking a question that's difficult for Naomi to process, to receive. It's hard for her emotionally. And so look at how she responds in verses 20 through 21. She says, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi gives herself a new name. She says, don't call me Naomi. Don't call me pleasant. Call me Mara. Mara in the Hebrew literally means bitter. She says, call me bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Now, in her bitterness, Naomi has offered to the women of Bethlehem three assessments of how God has treated her. She says, the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has testified against me. The Almighty has brought calamity upon me. Now, I want to come back to John Piper's observation. When we have decided that God is against us, we usually exaggerate our hopelessness. In other words, and in Naomi's case, our bitterness turns to blindness. You see, the truth of the matter is, God did not bring Naomi back empty. Rather, he brought her back with a companion of supreme devotion. He brought her back with Ruth. And he brought her back to a people who recognized her and who received her. He brought her back to a land that was no longer barren, but once again was experiencing God's blessing. So while Naomi is right here to, again, affirm God's sovereign control over all things, she is wrong to speak of God as though he's capricious and as though he's cruel. Her bitterness has made her blind to God's goodness. And she can't even see the grace that God has given to her, personified especially in Ruth, God's grace, which literally clings to her the whole journey home from Moab. When we kind of zoom out and take in the big picture of Ruth, and especially how this story fits into the greater biblical story, we can see some interesting similarities between Naomi and Joseph. First, Naomi and Joseph were both affected by famine. Naomi and Joseph each experienced painful providences. Naomi and Joseph were both used by God to save their people, Israel. I could go on and on and on with the similarities, but I want to highlight one major point of contrast between Naomi and Joseph. You see, whereas Naomi was convinced that the hand of the Lord had gone out against her, and she declared out loud to the women of Bethlehem that God had brought her back empty, had testified against her, and had brought calamity upon her, Joseph declared out loud to his brothers when he confronted them in Egypt, those same brothers who had hated him and sold him into slavery, who had no less than wished death upon him, the Joseph who, though innocent, had been framed by a wicked woman, this Joseph declared out loud to his brothers in Genesis chapter 50, verses 19 to 20, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for what? God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." You see, when you're confronted with the unimaginable, when you walk through the deepest possible pain, what you really believe about God presses through the seams of your soul. I think, if truth be told, most of us are more like Naomi than like Joseph. But we must be encouraged by Joseph, because, church, our God is able and faithful and good to take what is evil to us and to make it good for us. Now, this brings us to the final two verses and the conclusion of this chapter. It brings us back to God's providence. The narrator summarizes all of Act 1 in this way, in these final two sentences. "So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest." So we saw God's providence at work in the beginning of the chapter to draw Naomi back to Bethlehem. He brought food to his people. We see God's providence again working here at the end of the chapter when they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. You see, God brought Naomi back with Ruth in his own perfect timing, precisely at the beginning of the barley harvest. The barley field is where Boaz will first encounter and take notice of and be attracted to Ruth. So this chapter, chapter 1, begins and ends with divine providence. And this is not coincidental, but it emphasizes for us, God through his word, emphasizes for us the timeless truth that God is always in control. Always. Now, as I meditated on this text, as I prepared this message, as I thought and prayed and wrote and deleted and wrote some more, I felt very strongly that we should embrace three significant encouragements from this text. Three significant encouragements. So the first of those encouragements is this. Church, sometimes God's providence is painful, but it is always good. Sometimes God's providence is painful, but it is always good. Naomi was convinced that the hand of the Lord had gone out against her and that he had brought her back empty. But she couldn't see God's greater plan. She could only see with human eyes. Even more, her bitterness made her blind to the hope that he clearly did provide to her, the grace that he clearly did provide to her. Now, there is no way that Naomi could ever have imagined the plan of redemption that God had prepared for her through Ruth and Boaz, the plan of redemption that God was accomplishing through her in Ruth and Boaz. She could have never imagined that she would have a grandchild, and that that grandchild would father Jesse, and that that Jesse would father David, Israel's greatest king. In her wildest dreams, Naomi could never have imagined that her utter desolation would give birth to Israel's royal line, that God would make a covenant with her ancestor, David, that her descendant would be king of Israel, a man after God's own heart, and, most importantly, that his offspring, that his descendant, would be the King of Kings. Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus Christ, the Lord of the universe. You see, even though Naomi couldn't see it, God was working. Even though Naomi could not see it, God was working. There are times when God calls each of us to endure a painful providence. And we need to remember that when he does, though that providence is painful, it is most certainly good. In those dark nights, we need to live hopefully, and we need to trust in the name of the Lord our God. We must always remember that, like Naomi, we can only see with human perspective. We can simply not fathom how God has ordained our sufferings for our ultimate good and for the advancement of his great plan of redemption. When we look to Naomi's example, we're reminded that there is one timeless truth that we can hold on to in our pain. God's purposes for our pain are always good. The next encouragement that I want us to draw from this text is this: a painful providence is not necessarily a painful punishment. A painful providence is not God's punishment. Naomi endured a painful providence from God, not a painful punishment from God. There's a big difference. You see, the fact that the Lord ordains a painful providence for you does not mean that he is punishing you. It does not mean that his hand has gone out against you. You see, first and most importantly, the very essence of the gospel is that Jesus was punished in our place. And so I ask you these questions. Did Jesus' work satisfy God's terms of justice on our behalf? Was his work sufficient to pay for all of our sins? Does Jesus not right now, this very moment, as you're tuned in, as I'm speaking to you through this live stream, does he not make intercession for us at the right hand of the Father? Is he not our great high priest? If this is all true, and it is, then how could we ever be rightly punished by God as his redeemed people? We have a redeemer. And as his people, we must always remember the difference between discipline and punishment, the difference between providence and punishment. You see, God does not punish us. He does sometimes discipline us. It's often unpleasant, but it's always beneficial. Remember what the writer of the Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 12. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. You see, discipline presupposes, according to the scriptures, first, that we are God's sons and daughters. Second, that God has received us already. And third, that God presently loves us. Discipline does not mean that God is against us. And we must not forget Jesus' words to the church in Laodicea in the book of Revelation, a church that he himself calls out for being lukewarm, for being wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. Strong indictments against that church from the lips of Jesus. And yet Jesus says to that church, those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. So be zealous and repent. In Luke chapter 13, Jesus comments the fall of the Tower of Siloam, which killed a lot of unsuspecting people. It was just a disastrous occurrence. And in doing so, Jesus denies four common assumptions that people often make about God in the face of tragic suffering. First, that suffering is proportional to sinfulness, or that tragedy is a sure sign of God's judgment, or that bad things only happen to bad people, or even the assumption below those that we as humans, as God's creatures, have the right to even make those judgments about him. To each of those assumptions, Jesus says, no, not the case. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 that the Father makes the sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. But third and finally, I want us to be encouraged that God's providence always, always flows in the direction of Christ's glory. You see, part of the wonder of this passage is that God uses the darkest period of Israel's history, that he uses Naomi's most painful circumstances to bring about the glory of his son, Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Jesse, son of Obed, son of Boaz. What's more, God takes a spiritual outsider, a Moabitess nonetheless, and graciously grafts her into Christ's royal line, mercifully foreshadowing his grace and grafting each of us in as well. And this child that is born to Ruth and Boaz, this child that brings light to Naomi, is born in Bethlehem. We need to know that because divine providence flows in the direction of Christ's glory, it also therefore flows in the direction of Christ's blood. The Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 3, verses 22 through 25, he says, "For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness because in his divine forbearance, he had passed over former sins." You see, Christ's blood flows forward and backward in history. His blood purchased the blessings that Naomi would eventually see clearly, purchased the redemption that Ruth experienced through Boaz, and purchased the royal favor that Boaz was gifted to by God. His blood purchased the favor and blessings that you and I enjoy right now, today. His blood purchased our forgiveness, our cleansing, and our standing with God. There is no other means by which those things could be secured for us than the blood of Jesus Christ. Without Christ's blood, there is no remission of sin. Where there is no remission of sin, only guilt remains. Where guilt remains, the wrath of God remains. And where the wrath of God remains, there is no lasting blessing, but only everlasting misery. Church, Christ's blood has purchased everything. And therefore, it is his blood that we vest our hope in, our confidence in. In the final analysis, everything in this story, everything in Ruth, everything in this chapter points to Christ. Everything in this story is because of Christ. And everything in this story points us in the direction of his glory. Amen.